For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, the opportunity we're going to talk about here tonight is a different one, namely to get back into the book of Acts and to understand what God is doing in a broad and global sense in the world. We talked last time about the fact that chapters 13 to 15 is the beginning of this work of God out to the Gentiles. Christianity had been really restricted to Jews by and large up to this point. Jesus, of course, was Jewish. His disciples were Jewish. The earliest believers in Jerusalem were Jewish. But Jesus' commission to the church was to go out to be his witnesses, not just in Jerusalem and Judea, but in Samaria, which are not strictly Jewish. They're kind of hybrid, half Jews. And then he says to the remotest parts of the earth. And then he calls this guy named Saul, later will be called Paul, to take that message out to the Gentiles. And so in chapters 13 to 15 is the record of the first of three missionary journeys of Paul recorded in the book of Acts. Last time we talked about that he went down there to Cyprus with his buddy Barnabas. That's where Barnabas was from. They got a community of believers established there, mostly, it tells us, from among what are called God-fearers. And God-fearers are these people who are Gentiles, but they're just like they realize the dead end that Greco-Roman religion has to offer. It's like, where are these gods that are supposed to help us out? And they're nowhere to be found. And so they became over time interested in Judaism and the God of the Bible. And so they're really becoming conversant with the whole Old Testament framework, the whole idea that there's one God and things like that. And the church begins in Cyprus among those kinds of people as Paul appeals to the Bible and to say that Jesus is the fulfillment of all that the Old Testament paints in terms of the picture of the coming Messiah. Remarkable study. We talked about that last week. Tonight, we're going to talk about another incident. This is in another city up in Asia Minor. This is modern-day Turkey. And in Acts 14, verses 1 to 18, there's a different kind of crowd of people that Paul is beginning to reach and a different way, therefore, of communicating with them. These are what we might call, I suppose, the more hardcore Gentiles, people without any kind of real background in the Jewish concept of God. And so it then raises questions then about how do you communicate to people that you're not really reading off the same page with in terms of who is God. So it's a study really in communication in a world where people don't hold exactly the same beliefs, the same views. I think it's a very important study for our own very diverse, very pluralistic culture. Let's take a look. Starting in verse 8, it says, at Lystra, this is the city that we're looking at here, a man was sitting who had no strength in his feet, lame from his mother's womb, never had walked. And this man was listening to Paul as he spoke. When Paul had fixed his gaze on him and had seen that he had faith to be made well, Paul says with a loud voice, stand upright on your feet. And this young man leapt up and began to walk. This is in a crowd of people, probably as large as the crowd gathered here tonight, hundreds of people. And it says when the crowd saw what Paul did, they raised their voice saying in the Lyconian language, wow, God of the Bible, that was awesome. Or not, because they don't know the God of the Bible. They said instead, the gods have become like men and have come down to us. And they began calling Barnabas Zeus and Paul Hermes because he was the chief speaker. The priest of Zeus, whose temple was just outside of the city, brought oxen and garlands to the gate and wanted to offer sacrifice with the crowds. What a bizarre scene. And when the apostles and Barnabas and Paul heard what was happening, they tore their clothing in dismay and ran out among people shouting, "Friends, why are you doing this? We are just human beings, just like you. We have come to bring you the good news that you should turn from these worthless things and turn to the living God who made the heaven and the earth, the sea, and everything in them. In the past, God permitted all the nations to go their own way, but he never left them without evidence of himself and his goodness. For instance, he sends to you rain and good crops and gives you food and joyful hearts." But even with these words, Paul and Barnabas could scarcely restrain the people from sacrificing to them. Wow, what a bizarre situation. Well, it raises, I think, some very interesting points about the mission of God's people to the world around us and how to communicate to that world. It's all about the good news. That's the centerpiece. Paul and Barnabas, they're out in front of this crowd, and they're speaking a message. And in that context, they're also showing a message. And that's what you see. There's a pattern in the book of Acts that not only, and you see this also in the ministry of Christ, where there is a demonstration of the thing that is being taught. So that what we're saying is that to communicate in a biblical way, we want to be able to demonstrate in real terms the message that we're speaking. And in this context, God had given Paul the ability to effect healing. I don't think that happens frequently, and that's probably why it's recorded here, because it is so unusual. But what we do see throughout the scriptures and really throughout the church age, when the church is really doing what God calls it to do, is we're demonstrating the compassion and the love, the mercy of God through what we do, so that when we speak a message, it resonates with people. They understand the intent. They understand what it's about. That's why when we go to Haiti, for instance, we met with and treated 421 people. Each one of them cared for their physical needs, talked to them, prayed with them, so that when they heard a message that we were down there to give, they had a framework and a context to understand what we're coming from and what kind of God we represent. So that's a very important part of this communication process, showing the message. But and then two, Paul wants us to understand that this is not just like our message and this is really sweet and maybe you'll like it too. It's not a good news, it is the good news. And so it's not one religion among many, it's not one message in the cafeteria of possibilities. But Paul and Barnabas are going saying, you know, God has spoken definitively in his word and personally in his son. And so there is not a good news, there is the good news. There is one thing that God has really wants to get across to all of humanity. We'll turn back to that point later. The thing that I think is really cool about this and very important and what we want to really spend most of our time on tonight is the awareness that Paul and Barnabas, they're going out. These are Jewish men. They were steeped in the Old Testament and in Jewish culture. And they were really making a transition into not just a culture that was foreign from theirs, but also a way of thinking that was fundamentally different from their own. Jews, like Paul and Barnabas, were monotheists. They know that there's one God, one personal God, one eternal God who created all things, as the text makes clear. They're talking to an audience that believes that there are many gods. And indeed, maybe Paul and Barnabas are a couple of them, oddly enough. And so what we see here is that Paul is making this point that no matter where a person's coming from, and God, I think, is all about cultural diversity. That's an awesome thing. really reflects the diversity and the uniqueness that God has granted to humans to have. But what we find in passages like this is that no matter how much there is of our diversity, there is still one world of truth. And because God has made things the way he has, there is always going to be common ground to communicate to a person, no matter what they believe, no matter where they are from, that can point to God. And that is the very important message that's being communicated here. And Paul does this by a couple of means, by showing that we share God's world. And so no matter where you go, people have some semblance of an understanding of the way things truly are. And that is a foothold that points to God. And very importantly, Paul's going to point out that we share God's image. That there's something unique about human beings, that inwardly we know who God is because we are able to recognize that he made us uniquely and distinctly personal beings. So let's just take a look at this. It's just, I think, so very important. Just thinking over the last week and a half, talking to a 60-year-old Haitian journalist, steeped in voodoo, has no knowledge of Christianity at all. And yet to be able to connect and talk about justice and what is right, which he's deeply concerned about for his own people, that led very naturally to a conversation about, well, what's the basis for goodness and human rights, if not a God who created us? And on the way home, a 19-year-old from the Dominican Republic who just wants to make a life in America better than the one that he left. And so to be able to talk over 3 hours about, well, what do you mean by better? And what is a life worth living anyway? And that those kinds of conversations inevitably move us into the question of, well, who is God? Or our Chinese friends who are exploring and making observations about the world that can only make sense if there is a God, the God of the Bible. No matter where you are, no matter who is your neighbor, there is always a point of contact that draws people to the person of God. That's what we see evident in this speech that Paul gives here. Let's talk about this in particular terms. Paul begins to talk about God and his relationship to the cosmos. The living God, he said, who made heaven and earth. That's one place we can start. Okay, so we don't have a belief in the Bible, never read the Bible, but and maybe you have this idea that there are many spirits that inhabit the world or whatever it is. That's what the people believe that Paul is talking to. And Paul says, you know, here's the thing, though. There is a living God who made, that all that exists is the consequence of what he did. He made it happen. There is a creator, and it answers this question, no matter what culture you're from, who you are, why does anything exist? Everybody has that in their mind in some way. You know, we don't walk around thinking, now, why do I exist? You know, this kind of thing. But in the back of our minds, that is a question. Why is there something rather than nothing? Every culture has some sort of a stab at that question, an attempt to understand it. That's why mythologies are created, philosophies, and things of this nature. And what the Bible declares is that the universe has an origin. It has not always been, but God spoke it into being. Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And Paul clearly is here alluding to this fact. And interestingly, in the ancient world, they did have a belief that God was somehow responsible for creation. They couldn't quite figure out exactly how that happened. But interesting, in our own day, when we get into this question of the origins of the universe, the conversation actually has changed quite dramatically in most of our lifetimes, indeed. Up until fairly recent years, it was believed by scientists that the universe is infinite, that it has always been, that it always will be, until astronomers began to make key observations. Namely, that the universe is expanding and that it is expanding at a decelerating rate, and that the laws of physics, when played out, will show that the universe is going to stop motion at some point, which inevitably leads to the so-called Big Bang theory that says that since it's going to end at a certain point, it had to have also begun at a certain point in time. And this has kind of rocked the world of some of the people in our culture that we're rubbing shoulders with. Maybe the more hardcore, science-minded people who say to themselves, there's no place for a rational person to believe in God, this type of thing. Some years ago, the director of astrophysical research at NASA, a guy named Jastrow, not himself a man of faith in God at all, but he was puzzled by the growing body of evidence that astronomers themselves, like him, were amassing about the nature of the universe. And in light of that, the resistance of astronomers to accept the possibility that there's a God. So he wrote his book called God and the Astronomers, and it begins like this. For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He says, he has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He's about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who've been sitting there for centuries. That's hilarious. What are we saying? What we're saying is that the more we know about the world as it is, the more that points us to God. The more that the only explanation that makes sense is that there is a God who exists, who is infinite because the universe is finite, and of great power because he was able to bring about the massiveness that is this universe. And there is a place for us to talk in our modern culture to the scientifically minded that indeed there's a place for us to meet and have honest talk about God. It goes on further. Paul says that he's the living God who made the heaven and the earth, creation. And then he says, and everything that's in them. And so now he's becoming even more particular, and he's saying the more that we know about nature, the more that pushes us and presses us into an understanding of who is God. In the Greek world that Paul is speaking to, that they had a very strong belief in science. Science had been hundreds of years old by the time Paul is walking around through the Roman Empire. The Greeks, by 400 BC, had very advanced ideas about the nature of the earth and all manner of things. And they understood that by observing the operations of nature, that there must be what they called form, or the idea that there is a design inherent in nature itself, a telos, a purpose for all things in nature. That's what the Greeks believed. They didn't know why. They thought, well, what is the purpose? Who decided the purpose? But that nature is just random is not what we observe at all. And it's interesting, in our own day, the more that we know about the natural order, modern science is rediscovering the idea that the universe and specifically biological life itself is not just a random accident, a product of time plus inert chemicals interacting that produces life. Today, molecular biologists, people who study genetics, are increasingly becoming aware that to explain what is on the most basic building block level of life requires the understanding that what we're looking at is not accidental, but is actually the product of carefully ordered, intelligent design. I'd like to introduce you to a man here tonight who went through an important conversion in his thinking about this. Here's a guy who wrote a book on what he called biological determinism, genetic determinism, the belief that all of life came out of this inorganic soup that existed at some primal time in the past. That's the way it was. That's what most of us were taught in school. And then he began through his own research to become aware of the fact that that's just not going to get it. That doesn't explain the data. And so let's take a listen to this guy. Well, let me just give you a summary briefly before we do. Thomas Nagel, one of the best known philosophers of science in our day, has written a book called Cosmos and Mind. And in it, he says that chemical reductionism, the idea that everything reduces to just inert chemicals, chemical reductionism in biology is the orthodox view, and any resistance to it is regarded as not only scientifically but politically incorrect. Just not cool to talk about intelligent designer. But for a long time, I have found the materialist account of how we came to exist hard to believe, including the standard version of how evolutionary processes work. The more details we learn about the chemical basis of life and the intricacy of the genetic code, the more unbelievable the standard account becomes. This is not a Christian man. This is a guy who's working to understand and to explain the data of science. And so let's take a look at this video piece that explains what he's talking about here. Why don't you give it a run there, Charlie?
It's an enormous problem how you could get together in one tiny submicroscopic volume of the primitive ocean all of the hundreds of different molecular components you would need in order for a self-replicating cycle to be established. And so my doubts about whether amino acids could order themselves into meaningful biological sequences on their own without pre-existing genetic material being present just reached, I guess for me, the intellectual breaking point sometime near the end of the decade of the 70s.
As Kenyon reevaluated his theory, new biochemical discoveries further weakened his conviction that amino acids could have organized themselves into proteins.
The more I conducted my own studies, including a period of time at NASA Ames Research Center, the more it became apparent that there were multiple difficulties with the chemical evolution account. And further experimental work showed that amino acids do not have the ability to order themselves into any biologically meaningful sequences. The more I thought about the alternative that was being presented in the criticism and the enormous problem that all of us who worked on this field had neglected to address, the problem of the origin of genetic information itself, then I really had to reassess my whole position regarding origins.
With computer animation, we can enter the cell to view this remarkable system at work. After entering the heart of the cell, we see the tightly wound strands of DNA, storehouses for the instructions necessary to build every protein in an organism. In a process known as transcription, a molecular machine first unwinds a section of the DNA helix to expose the genetic instructions needed to assemble a specific protein molecule. Another machine then copies these instructions to form a molecule known as messenger RNA. When transcription is complete, The slender RNA strand carries the genetic information through the nuclear pore complex, the gatekeeper for traffic in and out of the cell nucleus. The messenger RNA strand is directed to a two-part molecular factory called a ribosome. After attaching itself securely, the process of translation begins. Inside the ribosome, a molecular assembly line builds a specifically sequenced chain of amino acids. These amino acids are transported from other parts of the cell and then linked into chains, often hundreds of units long. Their sequential arrangement determines the type of protein manufactured. When the chain is finished, it is moved from the ribosome to a barrel-shaped machine that helps fold it into the precise shape critical to its function. After the chain is folded into a protein, it is then released and shepherded by another molecular machine to the exact location where it is needed.
This is absolutely mind-boggling to perceive at this scale of size such a finely tuned apparatus, a device that bears the marks of intelligent design and manufacture. And we have the details of an immensely complex molecular realm of genetic information processing. And it's exactly this new realm of molecular genetics where we see the most compelling evidence of design on the Earth.
Well, I don't know about you, I find that awe-inspiring. It's amazing. It's a little technical. So let me summarize it like this. It takes DNA to make DNA. Okay? So the question, where does it come from, cannot be answered outside of DNA itself. That is the whole point. That's incredible. And it provides for us this amazing pro-science way of connecting with the world around us, that life at its most basic level is irreducibly complex and is masterfully engineered. And this is what the scientists are now discovering, that at the most incredible telescopic level of the cosmos, down to the most microscopic level of the molecule and even subatomic parts, we're seeing things that cannot be explained apart from an omnipotent, all-powerful, intelligent, creative act. So there is a place for us to talk in modern culture about the question of God. We can go further. He says, Paul says, that there is evidence, not just from the heavens and the earth, he says, but evidence of himself and his goodness. The personal dimension of God can be known to all people in all places and at all times, because we are all image bearers of God. There's something not just more complex, but something fundamentally unique about what it means to be a human being. Not a more sophisticated primate, but something fundamentally different. Not just motivated, not just actions and behaviors motivated by adapting to our environment or to survive and to reproduce. That's the narrative of nature and humanity without God. But that's not true of human experience. It's not enough to capture what it means to be a human being living in any culture at any time and at any place. I really like what Nagel, again in his book Cosmos and Mind, says. He says, an adequate conception of the cosmos. This guy's not a believer in the biblical sense at all. But he concedes an adequate conception of the cosmos must contain the resources to account for how it could have given rise to beings like us, capable of thinking successfully and about what is good and bad and discovering moral truths that do not depend on their own beliefs. In other words, moral truths that are actually out there, real right and wrong, stuff like that. There's something unique about humanity that simply biological complexity can't explain. How is it that while as everything else in the animal kingdom and everything else is hardwired by their biology to act in a certain way, yet we find humanity acting freely? We have free choice. That's something different about humanity than anything else that is. That we use language and reasoning for the purpose not just of adapting to our environment, but to understand our environment, to enjoy it, to recognize its beauty, to manipulate our environment toward useful ends. We're not just adapting or surviving. We're using our God-given minds to truly understand the world that He made, which then points us right back to Him. We recognize across cultures and across time that human behavior is driven and informed, as Nagel says here, by values, by notions of right and wrong, not just by instincts, the instinct to survive and to reproduce. And these things are just true of humanity. They are universal in human experience, and they give implication to what's really true. Just like the psalmist says in Psalm 8, verses 3 to 5, he says, when I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained, what is man that you take thought of him and the son of man that you care for him? Yet you have made him a little lower than God, and you crown him with glory and majesty. Psalm 8 is reflecting something that we all know about ourselves. Psalm 8 is reflecting the image of God stamped on the existence of all human beings. You're not an accident. You're not just the hapless, meaningless byproduct of a biological process that is blind to meaning. You're not merely a bag of chemicals that exists for no purpose. You know it. Everyone knows it. And only if there is an infinite personal God in whose image you are, can you explain it. There is no other basis to understand human dignity besides an infinite and personal God. And you possess amazing dignity and value. That intuition that you have about yourself is a true intuition. And the foundation for the truth of that intuition rests in the person in whose image you're made. But Paul then goes on. He's established we're just summarizing, I'm sure, what he was summarizing. There's a basis for us to think about the God who actually exists, the God of the Bible, based just on our observations of the world around us and ourselves as persons who are unique from everything else that we see in nature. But Paul then uses that. He goes on and he says, but there's a problem. He says, in the past, God permitted all the nations to go their own way. Okay, so there's great dignity. Dignity for every individual in the image of God. a basis that can be explained by nothing other than God's existence. If you're just the hapless byproduct of nature, you have no inherent dignity or value. Your value comes from what the value that you serve for somebody else, perhaps. And what is right? Well, right is the interest of the strongest. You know that's not true. You know that there's something majestic and extraordinary about what it means to be human. And part of what makes us great has the potential for corrupting us down to our very core. And this is the heart of the Bible's message that Paul brings up. He says that God created the nations, the Gentiles, and permitted them to go their own way. So God created us for the purpose of relating to Him. He created us as personal beings so that we would have a personal relationship with Him. But being personal means being free, and being free always carries with it the possibility of saying no, even if the person you're saying no to is God. And the Bible declares that this is exactly what has happened in human history from the very beginning, that mankind has said no to God. Mankind has chosen, we're going to go our own way. I'm going to be my own boss, my own God. I'm going to live for my own self. I'm going to do things my way. I'm going to live on my terms. And this is what the Bible calls sin. It's saying that instead of God's will and God's purpose, I'm going to manufacture my own. And so now we've got a conflict between a God who's designed us to draw our life from Him, to experience His goodness and His blessing in our life. We've rebuffed that. We've said, no, I'm going to go my way. And we're free to do that, but we're not free with respect to the consequence of that. And to violate our design that God intended for us to have always brings us pain, always brings us a corruption of our moral character. Our soul is broken. And that's the condition of humanity. That's why it is that even though we're so incredibly brilliant, what do we use our incredible brilliance for? To find craftier and craftier ways of killing each other. That's how come it is that it's within our reach right now, today, and has been for decades, to feed the entire planet. No one ever needs to be hungry in this world. And yet, millions starve. Why is that? It's because there's something wrong within the human heart. And you know it, and I know it. And the Bible declares our problems are not merely economic. They're not merely that we don't have good enough health care. They're not merely that we're not loved enough, whatever. The problem that we have at its core, the big problem that we have, is a spiritual problem, is a problem I've got with God, a controversy I have with God that I want to live life on my terms. And He's let me do that. But in allowing me to do that, it has brought us to this place where we are alienated from God. We stand under the judgment of a holy God. That's the human condition. There's a problem. But Paul goes on to say there's also a solution. What's the solution? It's called the gospel, the good news. The good news that it's possible to turn to the living God. That God has not abandoned us in our rebellion against Him, but has continued to pursue us. That's the good news. That in the gospel, the good news about Jesus Christ, that God has come into the world to live as a servant of humanity and to die a death that we all deserve. He took upon Himself, His own body, the judgment for the sin of all of humanity, for your sin and mine. So that what? So that we could call out to God and say, I'm guilty. I realize I've got serious problems. I'm distant. I'm alienated from You. But I hear that You have made a provision for me. You've provided a way to overcome this terrible obstacle that stands between me and you in Jesus Christ. I want to receive the gift of forgiveness that the cross of Christ provides. That is the good news. And Paul is going all over the Roman world with that very simple and powerful message, that the God of the cosmos that we all know, no matter what culture we're from, that there is an infinite, powerful, personal God in whose image we are created and from whom we are alienated, has moved to us, toward us, to deal with our alienation from him. That's the solution. And now briefly, just think about this in terms of application. What do we do with this truth, this reality? I think it's important that we realize that you can know God. That's what Paul's whole point is. Your questions can be answered. The intuitions that you have, the basic sense that you have, that something's got to explain all this stuff. Something's got to explain me, has an answer. Oh, yes, it has an answer. And the Bible declares that you can know God if we're willing to call out to him, to enter into a dialogue with him. God gave us the gift of language. That's why he reveals himself to us in his word. Not just in history, yes in history, but in his word. Because it's language that connects the mind of one person to the mind of another. The heart of one person to the heart of another is brought together through language. How do I know what I'm thinking? How do I know what you're thinking? We talk. And that brings a connection then between how I'm thinking and how you're thinking. And God has communicated his word to you, and God speaks to us through his word. You can know God if we just simply call out to him, say, I want to know you. I want you to reveal yourself to me. I want your word to come alive in me. He will answer that prayer. How about it? How about it tonight? Some of you are here tonight. Somebody dragged you here. We're glad you came. How about you? Maybe this is an opportunity for you to just to call out to God and say, I do want to know you. I want to hear from you. And I believe that you will speak to me in a personal way, in a way that I can understand. To put together these pieces, these fragments that I have about what is really true. I'm just asking you, God, will you give me that clear understanding of who you are in the midst of all of that? And God will answer that prayer. God will answer that prayer. That's the prayer of an honest seeker. And for the rest of us who've had our seeking satisfied, there's an important application to this. That there we can find common ground to relate to anybody. We sit in our cubicle at work or on our lawn chair out front or whatever it is. And I'm here to say that there is no person that you cannot relate to. There is no person that you can't have a meaningful spiritual connection with. Because why? Because of what we've just read. We all live in the world that God made, and we are all uniquely in his image. There is always a place to communicate. There's always a place to talk. Paul says to these people he's talking to, he says, you should turn from these worthless things. He's talking about idols there. He said, those idols can't capture what nature really is. Come on. Really? Zeus? No, Zeus is just a glorified man made in man's image. But what he is saying is that there are longings within that we put idolatrous names to. That every human being has longings that we want to have fulfilled, longings that we may personify as a god, but maybe we won't. Maybe we'll just know that we're driven by things that only God can supply. A longing to be desired by another. A longing to be needed by somebody else. A longing to be accepted by somebody else. A longing to make my life count in some way. Those are real longings. And those longings can only make sense and can only be fulfilled in relationship to God. That young man I was talking about on the ride home from Miami has a girlfriend. And you know what? They don't get along. Shocking. And so we spent a good bit of that time, that 3 hours, saying, okay, there's your will and what you want and what you long for. And there's her will and what she longs for and what she needs. And what you are doing is this. You are sucking the life out of one another. Pretty soon it's the gingham dog and the calico cat. Only the tails remain. He goes, yeah. I'm like, you know what? There's an answer to that. That longing to connect and to have intimacy and love, it happens when you are connected to God and you are receiving from Him acceptance, when you are receiving from Him the idea that you are okay, that you are desired, that you are loved absolutely. And then, therefore, because you're secure in that, you can give to the other. Oh, man, really? I thought it was a bust of a conversation until the end. I wrote down my email address. I said, hey, man, it's been great talking. If you want to continue, here's my thing. We're meeting up tomorrow. We're going to have that conversation. Why? Because he has legitimate longings that are unfulfilled and will only be fulfilled when he orients those longings, those legitimate longings, those real longings to God. There's an inner need for significance. We know that we are unique. We know that we matter. We don't know why we matter. And so we seek our significance in accomplishment. We seek our significance in the acquisition of things or competitively, of being better than the next person, whatever it is. Why do I matter? That is in the mind of every human being that has ever lived. Your own angst about that is not unique. Everybody has that. And that need to matter is a pointer to God. How will we do anything that really matters? We can only matter. We can only matter if what we are about has ultimate significance that doesn't just die with us. And that can happen only in connection with an eternal God with whom we will share eternity. That longing can only be met in relation to the God of the Bible. And most, I think, poignantly, there is a common notion around grace. He says, to turn to the living God is to recognize that where I've been is not where I want to be. And there is an answer to the universal human problem. How can I face my failures? How can I face the incredible disappointments that I've hoisted upon other people? How can I deal with myself knowing the things that I know about me that I can't suppress in my quiet moments alone when I'm not defending myself and puffing up my feathers before everybody else? When I know that I can only approach God on the basis of either His mercy or my complete self-righteousness. And that my own self-righteousness, well, isn't going to get it. Every human being has that pull, that dilemma. They don't know how to really deal with the problem of their failure and their guilt, their sin. Every human being has this problem. We cover it up. We medicate it. We deny it. We try to be better. We improve ourselves. But we never leave the recognition that that is a problem. I've got a problem. And there's an answer to guilt. A definitive, final solution. And that is simply to trust in the work of Jesus Christ, to say, to turn to the living God and say, have mercy on me on the basis of Christ, a sinner. And I love this passage so much. And I hope that you'll think about that here tonight. That there is always a place to relate, always a place to communicate. There is nobody who we cannot find common ground with and move meaningfully in communication toward legitimate longings, the need for significance, the profound need to be forgiven and reconciled. Every human being has these things, and no matter what the worldview, no matter who we're talking to, we will find common notions in the nature of creation and in human nature and in these things that we're describing right here, and we can all have powerful communication that God will use to help lighten people's paths and move them forward towards Him. So it's super hopeful to really think this way, moving toward my friends, seeking that common ground. Will you do that? Will you make that choice to move that way and do that? God will use that to open the doors of their heart. And there'll be a real moment of communication right there.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.